Hello, I'm Rachel Myers, the Associate Director of Barnett Educational Services, a division of Cambridge Health Tech Institute. We're here today to discuss the ParXL Biopharmaceutical R&D Statistical Sourcebook 2012-2013, the industry's leading resource for statistics, trends, and proprietary market intelligence and analysis on the biopharmaceutical industry. Supported by thousands of graphs, illustrations, and analyses, the sourcebook provides the latest intelligence on every aspect of pharmaceutical development, from product discovery to R&D performance and productivity to time-to-market analysis. The sourcebook is compiled by ParXL International and published by Barnett. ParXL is a leading global pharmaceutical services provider. I'm here with Mark Matthew, editor of the sourcebook and director of strategic research at ParXL Consulting. Mark has studied and written about the FDA's regulation of the new drug development process for over 25 years and has authored several textbooks on the topic. He actively consults with leading drug and biologic companies on various aspects of drug development. Mark has developed the ParXL Biopharmaceutical R&D Statistical Sourcebook since its first release and has been responsible for developing each subsequent edition. Thank you for joining us today, Mark. Let's jump right in.
Rachel, thank you for having me.
Each year, the sourcebook features hundreds of emerging metrics and benchmarks on the current state and direction of today's pharmaceutical and biotechnology industries, in particular in research and development. So I'd like to start simply by asking you, since you are the one and only person who has seen all the metrics, which trends or metrics stood out to you most this year?
Sure. Rachel, well, one of the things that really stood out to us this year was a sharp and frankly, very much a welcome rise in at least one key industry new drug productivity metric. You know, industry's performance each year is judged in several key ways. And among these is through the prism of new molecular entities or NMEs, entirely new drugs, which one could easily argue is the lifeblood of the pharmaceutical industry as we know it. One of the unique metrics that we track each year is the number of NMEs submitted for FDA review in 2011. Now, certainly, the purest measure of industry productivity is the number of NME approvals each year, since these are the products actually reaching the market, in which are very widely reported, in which were up nicely last year in 2011. But unlike many others, we not only track NME approvals, we also like to look at a slightly further upstream measure, industry's NME submissions, because it gives us an idea of what the near future might look like. Now, obviously, this is not a perfect metric in all senses, since we know that not all NMEs submitted to the FDA are approved at any point. On the other hand, it's impossible for NME approvals, the metric that all industry analysts quite appropriately follow most closely, to improve if NME submissions don't improve first, obviously. In fact, on a worldwide basis, we even saw new active substance approvals drop in 2011 after three consecutive years of encouraging increases. Global NAS approvals dropped from 42 in 2010 to 33 in 2011, a three-year low. So again, NME submissions represent a very interesting and important metric that isn't as closely followed or reported, but that is critically important to support the all-important new drug approvals metric. So NME submissions rose to 34 filings with the FDA in 2011, which doesn't sound that dramatic, I must confess, until you learn that it's up 79% from the 19 in 2010, which was a many-year low, in that the 34 submissions in 2011 matches the high during the 2000s. Industry has submitted, on average, 27 NMEs per year since the year 2000. So the 34 NME submissions in 2011 is a very nice and notable bounce over this benchmark. Now, to put the 34 filings in a bit of a longer-term context, it's important to point out that the drug industry averaged 43 NME submissions annually during the mid and late 1990s. So while encouraging, the one-year spike in submissions is still well off the real highs more than a decade ago. And Rachel, one final note here. The 34 NME submissions to the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, or CDER, don't include the six BLA submissions for 2011's therapeutic biological products, the monoclonal antibodies, the therapeutic proteins regulated by CDER. So in other words, it doesn't include the vaccines and cell and gene therapy products in blood regulated by the Center for Biologics Evaluation Research. So the therapeutic biological products, too, have seen an uptick, although the N remains quite small. Now, one other important caveat to all this, as I said, is that not all new drugs submitted to the FDA are approved. In fact, the FDA has traditionally claimed that only 80% of the new drugs submitted for review are approved at any time following the original submission, although FDA data over the last several years suggests that it may no longer be even that high and may be tracking closer to 70% today. But data over the last 2 years hint that there may be a modest improvement, at least more recently. Either way, however, it's clear that the spike in NME submissions in the U.S. is a positive, and taken together with some of the other trends that we see in late-stage clinical trials, this leads to hope, which frankly is long-awaited, that industry is on the cusp of reversing a long-term decline in new drug productivity, and the industry certainly has a ways to go on that count, since over the last several years we've seen some of the lowest annual counts of NME approvals in many, many years.
So that's what's happening in the U.S. Is there any evidence that other parts of the world have seen similar spikes in marketing submissions for innovative therapies?
Absolutely. In fact, there is. If we look at another of the world's more significant regulatory agencies, in this case, the European Medicines Agency, or EMA, it has also seen, in the last couple of years, a rise in applications for new medicines under its centralized procedure, through which companies can gain access to all EU markets with a single approval. The EMA saw submissions for new active substances, or NASs, as it calls them, rise slightly in 2011, although the 2011 rate did set a new record in Europe. But NASs in Europe are a somewhat broader category of medicines than NMEs in the U.S. and include such things as important modifications of already approved medicines. So the EMA's NAS figures can be difficult to read sometimes and challenging for us to compare to FDA data, although seeing the submission figures rise is certainly a positive. But EMA added just last month that, quote, most of the increase, unquote, in new applications has been what it calls new medicines. In fact, the agency noted that submissions for new medicines rose by over 40% from 34 in 2010 to 48 in 2011. And interestingly, these EMA figures exclude submissions for orphan drug products, which continue to rise in Europe and the United States. So certainly some positive news on that side of the Atlantic as well.
How much do we know, if anything, about the therapeutic areas in which companies are seeking drug approvals?
Well, we do know some things. So sticking with the EU here for a moment, we know that no less than 27% of all the new drugs being reviewed by the EMA as of March 2012 were cancer medications. All other therapeutic areas were very far back from this. The next was diabetes at 7% and immunostimulants, immunosuppressants at 4%. Somewhat of a different story here in the United States if we look at the FDA's pending new drug application workload. Cancer, while still a very active area, didn't represent as high a percentage of the FDA's pending workload as of year end 2011, although that may in part be due to the fact that many cancer products are being reviewed and approved very quickly within the FDA today, something that's clear in our own data and those of others who have studied it recently. As of year-end 2011, metabolism and endocrine products represented 15% of all NDAs pending before the FDA, followed by gastroenterology and inborn errors at 13%. Solid tumor cancers represented 7% of the FDA's NDA workload. If we were to add in NDAs for blood cancers, for which we don't have a discrete figure, unfortunately, then the 7% figure would be at least a little bit higher.
Sticking with innovation for the moment and metrics that are a bit further upstream, the Sourcebook always offers interesting insights into industry's clinical development pipeline, both in terms of activity and direction. First, what do the emerging Sourcebook metrics tell us about the level of industry activity in clinical development?
Sure. Well, the overall size of the global pipeline continues to grow. According to data that the source book features across many providers, such as Evaluate Pharma, Sightline, and IMS Health, among others. Sightline's Pharma Project database found that the R&D pipeline grew 7.6% in 2011, one of the biggest year-over-year increases during the last decade or so. Our own study across three key R&D pipeline databases found that the phase one through phase three pipeline increased 6.2%, so very much in the ballpark there. Now, we can also talk about the pipeline itself and what we can learn about the numbers inside the numbers. Over the last several years and until more recently, I would say, we had seen fairly solid and in some years more significant growth in the size of the early stage clinical pipeline, that is, phases one and two. At the same time, we saw the all-important phase three pipeline stagnate to a large degree. And this was a concern to those in industry and market analysts because to address the innovation deficit and the clear need for companies to develop new therapies to replace those that are losing patent protection, we needed to see that phase three pipeline grow. The phase three pipeline was also read as a sign that industry was not yet able to convert or translate emerging science and the growing number of innovative compounds into late-stage opportunities. So clearly, very sobering there. What we've seen in 2011 and so far in 2012 is very substantial growth in the phase three pipeline. In fact, it's the first time we can recall seeing two consecutive years of double-digit growth in the closely watched phase three pipeline metric. So the phase three pipeline was up 10.6% in the 12 months to May 12th, and another 11.4% in the 12 months to May 2012. In both years, easily eclipsing the growth in any other clinical phase, and really reversing in dramatic fashion, really, the prevailing trend for several years. So this really does, I think, help create an expectation or hope that the rise in new drug submissions that we saw in the U.S. and Europe in 2011 and that we spoke about a few minutes ago might become more than a one-year spike.
And do the latest metrics tell us anything about the direction of the clinical development pipeline?
Well, in the source book, we look at it from many different perspectives, as you know. Our friends at Evaluate Pharma look at this in a number of different ways, for example. First, from the perspective of biotechnology versus conventional synthetic drugs. So as of May 2012, 65.4%, or just under two-thirds of all development pipeline products, from early research to filed for approval status, were conventional small molecule products. Now, that's down a bit from a year earlier, when small molecule drugs comprise 70% of all development products. It really is consistent, I think, with the idea that biologics and biotechnology products are becoming more important and a greater focus for industry. Therefore, biotechnology products comprise 34.6% of the pipeline, up from 33% a year earlier. For the biotech products, it's also interesting, I think, to look at the product type breakdowns. Monoclonal antibodies, for example, comprise more than a quarter of all biotechnology pipeline products and 8.4% of the total pipeline, followed closely by bioengineered vaccines with very similar numbers and recombinant protein products, which comprise 21% of the biotech total. Together, these are the big three in biotechnology and represent about 72% of the biotech total. We also know from some of the Evaluate Pharma metrics in our source book that about 68% of R&D projects active today are organic or in-house projects, while 16% are in-licensed and 8% were obtained through an acquisition. We know, however, that in-licensing rates differ drastically within industry, with many of the larger manufacturers being quite active. Among top-tier companies, for example, analysis we conducted based on Sightline data showed that 49% of Sanofi's pipeline has been in-licensed, compared to 32% for Pfizer, 42% for GSK, and on the lower end, 22% for Lilly. There is perhaps even more variation for the biotechs, with Biogen IDEC in-licensing 49% of its pipeline, compared to 17% for Amgen. Another way for us to look at the direction of the pipeline is in terms of shifts by therapeutic area. This we can do by looking at industry submissions of new commercial investigational new drug applications, or INDs, which is a metric that we have tracked for many years now. And our best data here is for industry submissions to the FDA, which doesn't necessarily represent activity globally, but does represent a very large and important proportion of R&D activity worldwide, certainly. Not surprisingly, cancer still represents the focus of much of the R&D pipeline, although it's very interesting to note that we now see that this focus is becoming even more intense. Our data tell us, for example, that no less than 24.5% of all the FDA-regulated clinical trial starts in 2011 were in oncology, not even including leukemia and other hematologic oncologies. This represents a spike from a year earlier. In fact, the next closest therapeutic area is hematology at just 9% of all 2011 trial starts, which likely includes many more trial starts for blood oncologies. The next most active areas are metabolism, endocrine, and neurology, each at 8%, to just give you an idea how far ahead and how active oncology is relative to other popular and competitive therapeutic categories. It's also interesting to note that FDA-regulated clinical trials rose 12% in 2011, following two consecutive years of declines from the record high in 2008. Trial starts for therapeutic biological products saw trial starts decline in 2011, however, continuing a trend of volatility over the last few years with, again, a much, much smaller N.
The metrics by therapeutic area are very telling because they indicate where the action is and where industry is placing its bets for the future. Putting aside the new trial starts and looking at the makeup of the entire clinical development pipeline, what do your metrics indicate?
Well, again, not surprisingly, we still see oncology representing the plurality of R&D projects, although not nearly as dramatically as in the new trial start area. As of year-end 2011, oncology represented 17.6% of all active FDA-regulated clinical trials, our data show. While less dramatic than the 24.5% of all new clinical research starts, the 17.6% figure is well above other therapeutic areas. The next most active therapeutic area is neurology, comprising 7.8% of all FDA-regulated trials, followed closely by metabolism and endocrine at 7.7%. Again, as of year-end 2011. So I think taken together, all of these metrics provide a decent picture of what industry's R&D pipeline looks like and how it might be evolving today.
Trends regarding the shift of clinical trials from the United States, Western Europe, and other traditional countries and regions into emerging markets have been closely watched and widely reported in recent years. What do the new metrics in the new source book indicate about trends in this area?
Actually, this year, I'm happy to report, we have some interesting metrics around that, some suggesting that there may have been at least a temporary repatriation of R&D investment and focus to North America, at least. According to TTC data, tracking annual trial grant costs and trial data from the NIH's clinicaltrials.gov database, TTC calculated the estimated total clinical trial R&D spending by region in 2011. And during the year, spending in North America represented about 60% of the total, up from 57.2% in 2010. Interestingly, Latin America was the only other region to see an increase in proportional spending in 2011 to 5.1% from 4.7% in 2010. So very modest there. Europe captured only 24.1% of 2011 spending, down from 26.1% in 2010. Now, unfortunately, we're not in this analysis able to see how things may differ between Western and Eastern Europe, but overall spending was down there for clinical trials. And both Asia and Africa saw modest declines as well. So overall, we pinned the amount invested in clinical trials in the United States during 2011 at almost $81 billion, compared to $32 billion in Europe, $13 billion in Asia, $7 billion in Latin America, and $2 billion in Africa. We also feature in this year's edition an update of our own analysis of the number of clinical trials by country and region, with just over half of today's clinical trials having trial sites in the United States. Almost a third of today's trials have sites in Asian countries in Europe, according to our analysis.
The sourcebook always has so many new metrics each year on trends in R&D costs. What stands out in your mind this year?
Well, there is certainly considerable interest in trends regarding cost differentials between the more traditional markets U.S. and Western Europe primarily, in some of the emerging markets. And here, interesting trend data from our friends at TTC on trial site-related costs provides some, I think, some fascinating new metrics. First, we see that there remains a gap, in some cases quite a considerable gap, between, say, U.S. and European sites and those in countries such as India and China. In examining site costs from 2009 through 2011, however, TTC also shows how the gap is shrinking today. In the U.S., for example, the cost per patient rose just 6% over the last 3 years, but rose by 11% in Asia, 12% in Eastern Europe, and 17% in Latin America. Now, admittedly, the idea that cost differentials will eventually diminish is not necessarily revolutionary. It's been conventional wisdom that costs on a worldwide basis would level out at some point as demand for sites and resources in emerging markets continue to rise, ultimately pressuring capacity. But it's interesting that the metrics have started to show that the overall cost gap, while still very much there, has begun to shrink at least somewhat here. Obviously, though, cost is just one of the reasons why companies might look to conduct trials in non-traditional regions and countries, since their goals often today involve competing commercially within those regions as well. Let me add one more thing here. Interestingly, for the first time this year, TTC provided the source book with index costs for each country in each key region. Far too much to go into here, but one can see just how each country within a region compares against all the others in that region, which is quite telling. For example, when you look at Singapore's costs on the one side compared to those for China and India on the other within Asia-Pac. And TTC does this for Latin America, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and Asia-Pac as well. So intra-regional costs differ greatly as well.
The sourcebook also includes one of the largest collections of regulatory data available anywhere. My last question for you today, Mark, is what types of things stand out to you there?
Well, admittedly, we're in a very interesting period in terms of new drug approval trends at the FDA. It's particularly interesting in the context of PDUFA 5, the new User Fee Act, which was passed by Congress recently and signed into law just a few days ago. So under PDUFA 5, the FDA will be adopting a new drug review model whose goal is to increase the number of first cycle approvals for NMEs and BLAs for biological products, at least when first cycle approvals are possible and appropriate. And our data show just how important first cycle approvals are. Over the last several years, our tracking data indicate that NMEs that were cleared in the first FDA review cycle were approved on average roughly 20 months faster than drugs that took two or more review cycles to gain approval. And in this case, a cycle is just a decision point, which would ideally be an approval, but if not an approval, would be an FDA complete response action through which the NDA would get kicked back to the applicant. The applicant would be asked for more information or more testing, and then the applicant would have to resubmit for FDA review in the next review cycle. So as you can imagine, quite a bit involved, possibly, not just in terms of time, but also in terms of incremental sales gained or lost based on the first cycle decision. By our calculations, an estimated $580 million in incremental sales for each of the NMEs that were approved in 2011, according to sales projections for those drugs. So clearly a lot at stake there. The good news is that record percentages of NMEs and new biologics entities, or NBEs, as the FDA is calling them, being reviewed by the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research are gaining first cycle approvals today. And all of this is happening in the run-up to PDUFA 5, which kicks off a few months from now. And so these higher rates will, in some ways, be the benchmark against which first cycle approvals under PDUFA 5 will be judged. But for priority rated NMEs and NBEs submitted in FY 2011, about 90% have obtained approval in the first review cycle, what will easily be a record if this rate holds as the few remaining applications in the FY 2011 cohort obtain first actions. We've seen this rate as high as 80% in earlier years, the previous record, but we've also seen it as low as 54% as recently as 2009. We're also seeing significantly higher approval rates for standard rated NMEs and NBEs. Of the FY 2011 standard rated applications that have obtained first actions, about 55% were cleared in the first review cycle. Now, while that doesn't sound impressive compared to the 90% rate for the more important priority rated products, the 55% rate would easily be a new record under the user fee program, bettering the previous record, which was 47% in FY 2010. Over the last several years, the first cycle approval rate for standard rated drugs has been around 35% or so, to provide a bit of a longer term context. So it will be very interesting if we are to see even higher first cycle approval rates under PDUFA 5, since that is where some of the focuses will be put under the new iteration of the FDA's user fee program.
Well, that was my last question for today, Mark. Thank you again for taking the time to join us and for your answers to these questions. If listeners would like more information on this or other content in the 2012-2013 edition of the PAR-XL Biopharmaceutical R&D Statistical Sourcebook, or if you would like to purchase a copy, please visit www.barnettinternational.com or call 800-856-2556. Thanks again, Mark.
Thank you.